In the New Testament, Jesus spoke of Noah's flood when he said, "For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark, and they did not understand until the flood came and took them all away." Who were these people that were swept away by Noah's flood? Is it possible to find them in history? Travel with us to some archaeological sites spanning over 8,400 miles across the globe as we see depopulation events and changes in cultures all taking place within the same time frame. Welcome to the BC Messenger Podcast, real science, real Bible, real history, and real world. It's December 2025. My name is Steve Hall, and as we are each month, I am here with my wife, Jennifer Hall, bringing you the latest episode, episode number 41 of the BC Messenger.
Today, we're going to discuss a topic that we've had in the hopper for quite a while, something I've been excited about developing as a session for the ministry here. Just asking the question, who were the people who perished in Noah's flood? Can we answer that question? Do we know anything about the cultures and the people groups and the civilizations that in the New Testament says they were swept away? So that's what we're going to investigate today. And I'm thrilled to have our listeners with us as we take this journey. I feel a little bit like a college student who's like studied up for a test, you know, and my mind is kind of like filled up with a lot of information. But it's very cool, very intriguing pieces of content that we have to present to you today.
Well, hopefully we'll be speaking from the overflow of our studies here. And by the way, let me mention, our podcast this month is concerning the flood. Our podcast in January of 2026 is going to be a little bit more controversial. We are also going to be speaking about the flood, but we're going to be doing a book review of a brand new book on the flood that has just come out from another somewhat well-known group. You've probably heard of them. We're going to be explaining a little bit more of this at the end of the podcast, so don't go anywhere. But back to this month. Well, it's December, so it's also Christmas, and Helen is going to be taking us into the Christmas season a bit with her Helen's View this time.
Yes, she has a nice balance to our section, which is a little bit more of a somber topic, thinking about people groups who were destroyed in the flood. She's going to be talking to us about one of the most joyful, precious biblical accounts, and that is, of course, of the coming of the Redeemer into the world and where we see God's mercy on display.
So our podcast today it's unique. We are going to be displaying the dichotomy between God's judgment, of course, talking about the flood, and God's mercy. The coming judgment of God and the coming mercy of God through sending his son Jesus.
As we approach the Christmas season more and more, closer and closer here, we've been looking at Christmas music the past few days, getting ready for some special events. And we were talking about the Christmas hymns that show this dichotomy or the groaning and the longing of the people through the ages, you know, waiting for the redemption. You have like Isaac Watts' famous words, "He comes to make his blessings flow far as the curse is found."
And that's joy to the world?
Yes.
Joy to the world.
He's acknowledging the judgment and the curse. He's acknowledging the blessing of the Redeemer coming.
Right.
Another one we thought of was O Holy Night, which says, "Long lay the world in sin and error pining till he appeared." And right, that's sort of what our episode's going to illustrate for us today.
So today we are setting out to answer this question, who were the people who perished in Noah's flood? The real world people. Who were they?
Right. If you have a real flood and it destroys people, as the Bible says it did, then it'd be helpful to learn about those people and help to bring these biblical accounts out of fairy tale land and once again into the real planet Earth that we live on today.
Well, as we often say here, real stories have real dates, real floods have real dates, and the proper date for Noah's flood, based on extensive evidence and research, is 3520 BC. That's our anchor point. Today, our intention is not to get into why we say that's the date. You can do your own research. You can read articles that we have in abundance now and podcast episodes.
But in fact, you can get a book called Noah's Flood Happened, right, 3520 BC, which was published by Dr. Ardsma about a decade or so ago. And in that book, you will get the question answered as to why that would be the date assigned. Some of our podcast content was recently introduced to some large new audiences. And we did get one individual who emailed us through our podcast website and said, why do you say the date for Noah's flood is 3520 BC? And a question about the Exodus as well. And great question. Loved getting that response from an individual who said, you know, that's not right, is it? And so we were able to answer her. And of course, she's going off everything she knows from traditional chronology. And right. So, yes, but with that date, 3520 BC, which is well established by modern biblical chronology, the anchor points are numerous for fixing that on the timeline. And that's where you have to begin if you're ever going to be able to answer a question like, who were the people who died in Noah's flood?
Right. With that anchor point, that's the date, 3520 BC, we begin to investigate questions surrounding the flood. We can get real, concrete, and fascinating answers from various branches of science, including archaeology. So today, we are delving into this question, who were the people? We mentioned a minute ago, as we introduced the episode, Matthew chapter 24. Jesus talks about this event of Noah's flood. Jesus himself verifies the event of this great flood when he says the coming of the Son of Man will be just like the days of Noah. For as in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying, giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark. And they, these people, whoever they were, did not understand until the flood came and took them all away.
Yes, another Bible version says until the flood came and swept
them
all away.
Right.
And if that doesn't put a mental picture in your mind, I don't know what would. You know, just a flood coming and sweeping people away. And we're not the first to point this out, that Jesus obviously is treating the flood here as a definitely historical event.
Right.
Not something that was mythological or something that emerged from different legends, from different cultures. I mean, he's talking right. about people who were swept away and who were caught completely off guard, just like it was going to happen at his future coming that he's referencing when he's speaking there in Matthew 24.
Right. So who are these people? Who are these people groups? Who are these civilizations? What can we know about them in the real world? So we investigate today the lives, the cultures of people groups in specific areas. We can give you the places we're going
to
today.
I love this list. This is so cool
right.
to be able to list this off for you where we're going
and
today.
And we're
going to
just go right down through them quickly today. South Mesopotamia, Palestine, Greece, Ireland, and in North America. Evidence strongly supporting the hypothesis that all these people perished in a depopulation event. At the same time, around 3500 BC, we are giving the theory, very likely theory, that this was what's described in the Bible as in what we call Noah's flood. Major cultural break across continents of this world in the centuries following Noah's flood around 3500 BC.
Here is a quote from, get this, ChatGPT. Artificial intelligence is making its way into the podcast, but it's a great place to go to get summaries of information. And so,
what did we type in?
I don't know. You typed it in.
I don't remember.
Steve did a search for something as we were just beginning to gather the information for the podcast today, which, of course, our primary source is Dr. Aardsma's book, Noah's Flood Happened 3520 BC. But then we're adding more of our own research into it today, which is a little bit unusual because we're science communicators here, not really researchers. But in this particular case, we investigated some additional cultural breaks beyond what is talked about in the Noah's Flood book, because like we said, we have a date. And so it's not that hard to go investigating what's going on in other cultures at that date in history.
So I typed in something about give me civilizations with cultural changes. Was there a time in history where a number of them took place at the same time or something like that?
Right. You were asking it about the cultural breaks that happened
major cultural
in that
breaks.
Mid fourth millennium BC, the 3500 range. Right. So here's ChatGPT's summary that it gave to us.
It says historians see circa around 3300 to 3000 BC as one of the most dramatic turning points in human prehistory. Multiple major civilizations across the world underwent sudden cultural breaks. Urbanization, writing, political unification, collapse of older cultures, migration waves, and technological milestones. That is right at the time that we are saying the modern chronology shows the date of Noah's flood.
Right. The flood happens 3520 BC, approximately. It wipes out the vast majority, almost everybody, off the entire face of the northern hemisphere, which again, get that flood book we mentioned if you want to know
the details,
why we would say northern hemisphere. Wipes all those peoples out. And then gradually, civilization has to recover. And so in archaeology, if this is correct, you are going to have breaks in culture that the archaeologists are going to recognize within that time frame, those centuries surrounding, especially following Noah's flood. An old culture stopped and a new culture began. And most likely there's going to be some large gaps of time in there. And when you're doing something like archaeology, it's easier to see what is there than what isn't there.
Right.
So, you know, depending on how detailed the archaeology has been able to be, we can get very specific information in some cases, not as specific in others. But ChatGPT acknowledges the fact that one of the most dramatic turning points in history is between 3300 to 3000 BC. And certainly, if you have a hemispherical flood wiping out civilizations, it's going to be a dramatic turning point in history. So we're going to investigate that today.
And nowhere else are you going to hear this specific detailed information about Noah's flood. You're not today, at least as we're recording this podcast, you're not going to hear this anywhere else. Other Bible-believing groups have not been able to pin a functional date on Noah's flood. Now, there's a reason for that, and this stops them from knowing anything much about the flood outside of what they see in the Bible. We all know this, but let me just sum this up real quick. There are those who do not believe in Noah's flood at all, right? There's those who believe it's, we've already mentioned, myth and legend, it's made up. For instance, famous archaeologist William Deaver said, most biblical scholars regard most of the stories in Genesis as myths. It's all myth. Okay, there are those. There are those who believe the biblical accounts are spiritual and not meant to be taken literally. So those are those who don't even believe the story. But then there are those who do believe in the story of Noah's flood. But some say, of course, it was only a local event that happened in that part of the world where this account was written. There are the old creationists who say that it was so long ago in the past, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of years ago, that we could never find it, not really, and put a date on it.
The old earth creationists, correct.
And then there are what we call today the young earth creationists, who it's completely opposite. They say, well, the earth was so destroyed by the flood that there's no way we could find the date for Noah's flood and find the people groups that were destroyed by it.
They won't talk to you about people groups being destroyed, but they definitely will talk to you about fossils all over the globe, regardless of what those fossils date to. They all must be attributed to Noah's flood.
Right.
But no, they're not going to talk to you about civilizations being wiped out because, as Steve mentioned, they do not have a functional date. And everything, when you're studying history, everything does rest on chronology.
Right.
You have to have that date on that timeline before you can go about trying to answer any specific questions about that specific event.
Right.
And so, no brag, just fact that over here at the Biblical Chronologist, it's very unique, fascinating information that you're just not going to hear other places.
We are not saying that it's myth and legend. We are not saying that it happened way, way back somewhere in history. We're not saying the earth was destroyed by cataclysm and we can't find it. We are saying that a deluge of water, just like the Bible says, covered this earth and people were swept away, just like the Bible says. So let's get into it today. Depopulation event, change in culture. Dr. Aardsma states this: the main thing to look for in connection with the flood at a site is termination of occupation or depopulation. This evidences itself as a break in the cultural sequence of a site, and this leads to the archaeologists giving the new cultural assemblage a different name. So we have the date of 3520 BC. Middle of the fourth millennium BC, that Dr. Aardsma's research has shown is the date of the flood. And this is where we are looking for this change in culture across the world, not just one culture, not just in a local event, but are there depopulation events that take place in various spots around the world?
Right. Now we have to go investigating the real world. We're making a claim that Noah's flood was real and that it happened at 3520 BC. And now we have to go and look and see if the real world evidence corroborates that idea or falsifies it. If we find cultures all over the world that were just going on uninterrupted during that millennium, then you know what? That's not going to back up your claim that a flood came and swept everybody away at that time. So we are going to make six stops today in archaeology. When Dr. Aardsma says the main thing to look for in connection with the flood at a site, he's talking about archaeological sites. And of course, none of us here at the Biblical Chronologist are archaeologists ourselves, but we have so much careful work we can draw on today. Some of the work that we look at, even on the podcast today, was only done like in the 90s. So there's more and more information always coming out. And that's what we're looking at, is the work of archaeologists and what they're documenting about the ancient past. And we're looking to see if they're recording cultural breaks, at least during the time frame of Noah's flood.
Right. Now, let's mention something. What do we mean when we say time frame? The date Dr. Aardsma has established for Noah's flood is 3520 BC, in the middle of the fourth millennium. Now, you will have, and he talks about this in his writings, you will have some dating uncertainties. When you go this far back in history, I mean, we're over 5,000 years back in history, there are going to be inaccuracies of potentially several centuries. That's very possible. As more accurate and reliable chronologies continue to be put forth, these things can be changed. But there is that possibility that there are some centuries that are not accurate. So today we may talk about a date that's being shown around 3200 BC or 3300.
For example, right.
Right. And that doesn't mean this isn't what we're looking for. It's in close enough proximity to say, okay, that is in the range.
And there are other signatures of the flood as well to look for too. But you know, breaks in culture don't happen that often in archaeology. So your options of what you're looking at are going to be fairly minimal to start with. And it helps that way to narrow down. Another thing is just, you know, starting with believing the historical narrative of Genesis gives you a lot of context for what you are then looking at in the archaeology. And and looking at the archaeology gives you context for what you're reading in the Bible. So it's a two-way street there.
Right.
And the Bible believer doing honest science and keeping an open mind and their eyes and ears open has a lot of advantages in really in understanding the history of our world. But we don't want to do it from a biased standpoint. If our ideas are being falsified, we want to acknowledge that as well. So let's get started on our six stops here, starting
let's get into
with
it.
What is our first archaeological stop?
The first stop is South Mesopotamia. It makes sense for this to be our first stop because this is the location where the event, according to the Bible, took place, where at least Noah recorded what was going on. This is what we know of today as southeastern Iraq, South Mesopotamia. This is the location described in the opening chapters of Genesis. We read in Genesis of the Tigris River, the Euphrates River. We still know of these rivers today. This is near the head of the Persian Gulf. So what we're asking is there a collapse in culture, a change in culture, which would also be considered a depopulation event, in South Mesopotamia, at the time frame of what we've established here as Noah's flood?
The archaeological site is called Uruk, one of the most ancient cities in the world, the largest settlement in southern Mesopotamia back that far. It was a true city dominated by monumental mud brick buildings decorated with mosaics, painted clay cones embedded in the walls, extraordinary works of art being done there. And again, note, this is a real world location. We know where this is today.
Right.
We're talking about real world on this podcast. Large scale sculptures and relief carvings appeared for the first time, together with metal casting. Simple pictographs were drawn on clay tablets. And the thing about Uruk, one of the main things about it is it's known to be where cuneiform began to emerge, which was where they were doing a primitive form of writing on clay tablets, which in fact would have been how Noah recorded the events of the flood as well. Okay, so it's the Uruk culture, civilization there down in that area.
Going right along, and then suddenly in the fourth millennium, middle of the fourth millennium, archaeologists date it at 3200 BC. There is what is called, quote, the late Uruk collapse, sudden change in culture. Something happened. Archaeologists say it was terminated by a hemispheric and possibly global event.
That's amazing.
Isn't that something?
That is a strong statement right there.
That's right.
By those archaeologists.
It was accompanied by widespread depopulation. And then followed by the inception of human government. Now, we didn't mention this a minute ago, but there are a number of things we are looking for. According to the biblical account, the flood is going to be evidenced by a large body of water covering the highest mountains, ancient civilizations all but exterminated, complete destruction of human populations, as well as the origin of human governments. God establishes, for instance, capital punishment after the flood. And here in South Mesopotamia, we see the inception of human government following this collapse, this change in their culture.
Right. And it's amazing that they can learn all of that from the archaeology. You could go there today and you could visit in southern Babylonia the vast landscape of ruins that was known as the ancient city of Uruk. And so people were living there. Then suddenly at 3200 BC, approximately, the civilization collapsed and everything that was there pretty much ended. And that's what we know from archaeology. And definitely that's the kind of thing that we expect to see if a flood came and swept them all away.
That's right. Well, let's travel a little further now. We're now going to go approximately 948 miles to Palestine. Now, we all know where Palestine is today.
Yes, and I mean, you want to talk about archaeology. Palestine is the biblical lands. It's where Moses walked. It's where Jesus walked. all this detailed biblical history was recorded pretty much in this centralized area. And so archaeology has been a branch of science that has been of great interest in this region. And it is between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. Now, I do want to point out that this stop, like you said, is almost 1,000 miles from our first stop. And some people want to talk about Noah's flood. Yes, you know, some sea overflowed and some regional area. And so, yes, you know, a legend came forth,
fantastical story
about all of this and God saving a family and everything. But we've already jumped 1,000 miles and we're going to look at archaeology 1,000 miles away. And if we're able to find another break in culture here, it's going to strengthen the idea that no, we're not talking about some local or regional event. We've already traveled 1,000 miles. So what do we find in Palestine in the archaeology going back to the 4th millennium BC?
Well, the term here in Palestine is called the Chalcolithic period. And in the middle of the 4th millennium BC, this period in this area is terminated. Now, archaeologists set the date, again, the varying in a couple centuries or so, at 3600 BC. So here's a culture that were advanced in art, metallurgy. They don't appear to show any sign of human government, you know, during this Chalcolithic period. There's evidence of cruelty and violence within the human remains of this period. And then the entire civilization suddenly disappears without a trace, right where we would expect it with the new date or the corrected date of the flood.
Yes, the Chalcolithic period terminates in Palestine around 3600 BC, according to the archaeologists. And here's what one archaeologist says. The impression is created of a sudden end to the period as a result of a catastrophe of some sort. Because if armies come in and conquer the people, you're going to see that in the archaeology. If they burn the city or whatever, that evidence is going to be right in front of you. Now, if a flood comes in and sweeps everybody away, you're not going to be able to pinpoint and say, oh, look here, it was a flood, because everything's kind of missing and everything kind of stops at that point.
Right.
And so that's why they say, you know, we get the impression there was some kind of catastrophe.
Right.
And those who come after them seem to start from scratch. People did come in the centuries following, but they're not as advanced as the Chalcolithic was.
Right.
They are having to backtrack with their technology in the early Bronze people who followed after this civilization.
If you study the Chalcolithic sites and period, archaeologists talk about the abandonment. That's how they say the abandonment of these sites and wonder at it. Well, wonder what happened here. Again, stressing that the termination of this culture is dated at 3600 BC. That is right there with the date of Noah's flood, 3520 BC, middle of the 4th millennium BC. Again, no evidence of organized government in Palestine during the Chalcolithic era, but the early Bronze, which was what followed it, is characterized by government, city-states, its own ruler, its own king in that area.
And, you know, the evidence in the archaeology of the cruelty and the violence right there within the remains of this period, the Bible tells us that every thought of man's heart was only evil continually.
Right.
God says that, I think, to Noah. He says, I'm seeing this. And even the archaeology seems to record it. And when the flood came, it didn't tear everything up to the extent where these things weren't preserved. A lot of water came in and a lot of water went out, but certain things and many facets of these early civilizations were able to be left in place,
preserved.
We can still see them today.
Well, the flood was a flood. And unfortunately, we have had people come along and add to the Bible things that are not in there. And yes, if a deluge of water simply comes in and it sits there for a while and then moves out, you know, if something's attached to the ground or buried underground It's not going to go away. We didn't have this great tearing up of the planet. So yes, now two locations with two very real people groups in real world history suddenly have a collapse in their culture at the same time, middle of the fourth millennium.
And these are very long-standing civilizations.
Right.
They didn't just pop up, you know, 100 years before they were terminated. They were there and they were getting more and more advanced as time went on in these very early times.
And a change in a culture like this doesn't happen every day, and especially simultaneously with other cultures.
Right. So we've seen an example in South Mesopotamia and then Palestine. Now we're going to travel 780 miles across the Mediterranean Sea to an area of the world that did have some very long-standing populations by the fourth millennium BC. You may have already guessed, where are we going? From Palestine across the Mediterranean, 780 miles, we are going to end up over in Greece, our next stop.
Here, once again, we find a break in culture. It's the termination of the final Neolithic in the Aegean culture. And Jen, did this happen anywhere near the time that these other cultures had a break in their culture?
Archaeologists say that the final Neolithic terminated approximately 3200 BC, and then the Bronze Age began after that, which they pin around 3000 BC. So once again, we see an era come to an end. We see a sudden break.
So it's called the Neolithic.
Yeah, the final Neolithic culture there in Greece, which Greece is so interesting to study because you have some groups that are dwelling inland, and then you have a lot of islands and things, and you have coastal peoples and the lives that they were living there. Here's some things I learned about these pre-flood peoples in this area who we are saying were swept away by the flood at the termination of this final Neolithic. They had independent towns surrounded by walls. I saw pictures of these, you know, recreated online. They had specialized industries there in Greece for things like pottery. There are some sites that are several acres in extent that have, on the archaeological site, they have maybe 30 houses and a gate. They found striking red and white pottery for the people that were living there right before the time of Noah's flood. I saw that a lot about these final Neolithic cultures. They really liked red and white pottery. Huh. I don't know, you know, was that their national colors or something? I don't know, why would they want to use that so much? In the late Neolithic, walled communities with special big houses that had central halls, you know, like community meeting places kind of a thing. They were farming. And we'll see this come up again later too in other areas. They had copper weapons, and the warfare began to rise, causing them to have to defend more of their settlements and things. Their houses were made of rectangular stone. And here's something interesting. I learned a new word, apsidal. Apsidal buildings, which means that the end of the building was circular, was rounded. And this is one of the first places that we see that. So these are people before Noah's flood that were building, you know, very pretty dwelling places. You know, make me a circular part of the house down here. And they had silver and gold and copper jewelry and pottery, of course, that was red and white. And they were making figurines in this area as well that we can find today. And they also began to have organized cemeteries back in these very ancient times.
So very established culture going on for many, many, many years. But then in the middle of the fourth millennium BC, everything changed.
Right.
We have the transition from Neolithic to the Bronze Age in the Aegean, and this is marked by changes in all that you described there, changes in that pottery. Now it's different. Other aspects of their material culture.
I love this statement that I found on Britannica.com. These changes may reflect the arrival in Crete and the Cyclades of new people from lands farther east, bringing knowledge of metalworking with them. In Crete and the islands, the changes that inaugurated the Bronze Age were more or less contemporary with the beginning of dynastic times in Egypt.
So migration.
Yes. So, I mean, over in Egypt, you had something new starting as well at the same time as something new was starting there in Greece. And they're saying new people may have arrived in the area.
Right.
Well, yes, if everybody is swept away by a flood and there's very, very few people remaining to begin to populate the earth again, then, yeah, in the following centuries, you are going to have new people arriving with new ideas, new technology, different from what was there before. And so once again, there in Greece, we find the termination of something and the start of something new, very close to the established date of 3520 BC for Noah's flood.
That's right. So we've now seen three cultures who have had major changes in the middle of that same fourth millennium BC. We're going to travel again. Now, this time, we're going to go a good ways out, over almost 2,500 miles, 2,487 miles to the northwest, to a great big island called Ireland. And here, boy, do we have a strong evidence of change in culture at the same time. Middle of the fourth millennium BC. Let's talk for a minute about Ireland.
I can't wait for the day when we can begin to produce some videos with this type of content, because
right.
I can just visualize in my mind, you know, the map kind of turning and expanding and this big arrow going up. Now we're going to look at archaeology up here in Ireland. And this has got to be one of our favorites to talk about,
yeah.
Because it's just so fascinating. And this is one of the ones that really, I mean, we are both not yet 50 years old. We're getting close.
Very close.
But we're not there yet. But this archaeology at this place in Ireland has all been done during our lifetimes.
Yeah. Yeah. In the 70s is when it was first excavated, and a visitor center opened up in the mid-90s. I think it was actually 1993 we saw on the video.
Yeah, so maybe a few years before we were born, but not many.
But the technology, the archaeology is fascinating. And I'm always just amazed at what people do and how God has blessed mankind with abilities to study and research. And in this particular case, in Ireland, we've read about how it's pollen. You know, they're researching the pollen of the area, and they're seeing how Ireland had forests, just like in America when the settlers came over. The forests had to be cleared by the people in order to have the fields to farm and to grow food. And what we see here from 4100 BC, okay, 4100 BC onward, for about 600 years, the first settlers of Ireland came in and cleared the trees back and made the fields for farming. But suddenly, in the middle of the fourth millennium BC, there occurred a sudden reversal. Starting near 3500 BC, the archaeologists are seeing that the fields rapidly began to disappear and the forests started growing back and reestablishing themselves again. And by 3100 BC, 400 years later, the fields are fully overgrown by trees again.
Yeah, it's amazing. I don't know how you would study pollen or preserved pollen. You can look that up if that's of interest to you. But that's where some of these dates are coming from.
Right.
For this very unique site there in Ireland, which is called the Caja Fields.
Yeah.
Caja Fields. You can go there today. They have built a visitor center. It is a Neolithic site. And I mean, you can't go to very many of these around the world today, but this one was preserved under a peat bog.
Right.
Nobody knew it was there. It was there for thousands of years, preserving this ancient civilization and way of life, until a local guy went out trying to get fuel for his fire or something and was digging down through the peat and began to hit stones below and began to realize these stones are like laid out in some kind of orderly fashion that I'm hitting. And that guy's son grew up to be an archaeologist and began to do the work there at Caja Fields, which is now known to us today as an ancient farming community. Livestock was what they were farming, spanning I thought I saw 2,500 acres, but then I think Dr. Ardsma in one of his writings on this said it was 4,500 acres. So, I mean, whatever it was a huge
for ancient
area.
Peoples. Yeah, this is huge.
And it's the stone walls that denote, you know, a lot of the way they had things sectioned off. And it's just gorgeous in the videos. You see these people walking through this area and it's, you can overlook the sea all over around it. It's like this high, flat plateau where these ancient Irish people, like you said, yeah, came in, cleared the forest.
Cleared it out.
And began to farm it.
And put these stone walls up to, I guess, maybe divide off their fields for the families. Who knows?
I don't know, the cattle too, I guess. And the cattle, they had to pen the cattle in.
Yep. But then something happened. Again, this all began to be cleared around 4000 BC, but termination of this agricultural community about 500 years later. To this day, archaeologists don't know what happened. Like the Chalcolithic, in the same time period, middle of the 4th millennium BC, they wonder at the, quote, abandonment of the Cajia fields. They don't know where they went. Were they run off by some people who came in, or was it environmental? They talk about that, environmental reasons in the soil.
They'll bring up climate change. That's a term that you'll hear a lot as these archaeologists discuss, you know, what might have happened. But yeah, you do have to wonder, why would you have such a beautifully established farming community with even farmhouses and different things I read there, and then everybody just leave?
They're gone.
Where would everybody go, and why would they want to
Tools are left. Right. Houses are left. And all of this has been discovered and has continued to be discovered in that very same time frame. We're now at location number 4, going around the world, and at the proper date for Noah's flood described of in the Bible.
And it's really heartbreaking to me. You know, there are these people living there in Ireland, overlooking the sea and developing a culture. And don't forget that according to Genesis, these people didn't live 80, 90 years like we do today.
Right.
All these people in all of these cultures that we have discussed up to this point and at this time in history, according to the biblical data, they were living hundreds of years.
Right.
So they had a long time to get things figured out there at Cajia Fields or anywhere.
That's a whole different perspective, isn't it? The same Bible, the same historical record that talks about this depopulation event, which we know of as Noah's flood, also talks about these long lifespans. And these people we're talking about today weren't living, like you said, what we expect in life expectancy. They were living hundreds of years. Some of these people may have been in these Cajia fields for that entire time we
just
talked about.
That's exactly right.
400 years.
They may have arrived there as a settler and began settling that land and clearing the forest, and they may have been there when Noah's flood came and swept them away.
Swept away. Yeah.
Amazing. But it's sad, you know, to think about all that those people achieved and everything that they built around them, and then how it was swept away in this judgment of God. And it's hard for us as humans to wrap our brains around God's judgment and God's sovereignty in these things. And we don't know if God showed mercy to these people. We know he did to Noah's culture, which was down there more in South Mesopotamia. Noah preached and tried to warn the people. And we don't know what God may have done or not done in these other cultures, but we can see the signs that are left for us today that there was a thriving group of people there, and then they were gone.
Well, we can certainly see whatever the whys are behind it all. We can see the reality of it in the real world, that this did happen. And now at the fourth location, let's get to our fifth location today. And we're now going to jump an even greater extent into an area we're more familiar with here in America, 3,669 miles across the Atlantic Ocean, going into North America. Is there any way we're going to find evidence in the same time period of depopulation events, changes in cultures? Well, we're going to go specifically to the Great Lakes.
Yes, we're flying across the Atlantic Ocean, and we're going to land up somewhere near Lake Superior. And what do we find in archaeology here in North America? which, as Steve mentioned, is a lot closer to home for most of us than the areas that we've discussed so far. But Noah's flood as a hemispherical event definitely covered North America. And you can see that again in the book, Noah's flood happened 3520 BC. But this is a longstanding area of interest for me. Pretty quickly after we came on staff here at the Biblical Chronologist, something caught my eye in the news. And I'm not a scientist, as I previously mentioned, but I saw something about redoing of radiocarbon dates for the old copper culture. And this was maybe 2020, 2021, somewhere in there. And that the dating that had previously been done was being pushed a lot farther back for when that old copper culture began and then when it was terminated. And I saw that the new date of termination was very close to the 3500 date for Noah's flood BC. And so that caught my eye. I saw a couple articles on it and I sent those over to Dr. Ardsma and I said, you should look at this because I think the termination of this old copper culture may coincide with the date of Noah's flood. And this is, you know, North America. And I know he has wanted to look at it, but he's had too many other pursuits taking his time since then. So we are presenting this on the podcast for the first time. And this is our personal hypothesis that the old copper culture, the Native American culture up there by the Great Lakes was indeed terminated by Noah's flood. And we're going to explain to you why we would say that.
Right. Now, we're talking about a lot of dates here and a lot of cultures and terms. So give us a quick explanation. What are we talking about with this old copper culture near the Great Lakes?
Yes, it's one of the oldest metalworking societies in the world. And in fact, when these new dates came out, the big stir that it caused was that it was so much older than everybody thought. Wow, they were working copper. You know, I think it's like 8,500 years ago or something, longer ago than everybody thought. And so that was really the real focus of everybody's attention. And YouTube videos were being made and everybody was talking about it and putting their own, you know, spin on it or whatever. But that was the big thing. Like, wow, we've dated some of these really ancient. Huh. So this was a very ancient culture that was working the copper. Not so much focus being placed upon the fact that it was terminated or that it sharply declined. But anyway, yes, these ancient Indians, Native Americans, had copper available to them, especially surrounding the Great Lakes. There were hundreds of old Indian copper pits up there that you can see today. To say that there are thousands would not even be exaggerating, one researcher said. They extend from a few feet to as much as 30 feet into the gravel and into the solid rock, these copper pits. And so the artifacts left behind up in these areas are just plentiful. People who live up in the areas around the Great Lakes sometimes will have buckets full of copper artifacts in their basement because they've just collected them from all over the place. So that's a lot of things to be able to do associated, you know, radiocarbon dating. And we should mention that with Dr. Ardsma and his specialty in radiocarbon dating, he's always talking about tree ring calibrated dating methods that give us such reliable results and give us a definitive answer if things were either pre-flood or post-flood based upon the chronology we work with here.
So once again, what you're describing is an established culture from these American Indians there in North America, here in North America, and going right along for a long time with their copper production. And this is, of course, what we're seeing in archaeology. But we did another AI summary and went to artificial intelligence, to ChatGPT, I guess is what we're using, and typed it in to see, was there a marked change in their culture? And if so, at what period? And let me just read this to you.
I think what I typed in was, when did the old copper culture end?
Okay. And here was the answer that it spit out. The old copper culture, Native Americans, ended around 5,400 years ago, or 3,400 BC. marking a decline in its use of copper tools. New evidence suggests this period saw the abandonment of copper tools in favor of stone and bone, with the culture gradually fading. The exact reasons for the decline are not fully understood, but may be linked to the difficulty and declining value of copper tools compared to stone, or to a dry period that made mining more difficult. It's interesting, in all of these cases, the reasons given always seem to include environmental factors, which makes sense. A drier period of climate, and in this case, talking about declining value of copper, I mean, it's becoming very obvious here in our podcast. We're now into our fifth cultural decline. I think it's pretty obvious what happened.
It's amazing to me that, again, this AI summary uses the word abandonment.
Yeah.
So in this case, it's saying the copper tools were abandoned, and then they began to use stone and bone. Well, yeah, if everybody is swept away in a flood, then they're not going to be using the copper tools, and it's going to seem to be abandoned. So again, a break, an ending to a long-established era.
Middle of the fourth millennium BC, same time frame, give or take a century or two, again, which is what is expected.
After peaking between 7,000 and 5,000 years ago, which from now back to Noah's flood is about 5,500 years. So that's it says that between 7 and 5,000 years ago is when the copper tool use peaked, and then it's declined significantly.
Mysteriously
after that
faded.
Yeah,
mysteriously faded was part of how it was described. Amazing.
Right. And again, these are real people. You can read about what they were doing. They used various techniques to extract the copper out of the bedrock. They used a lot of manual labor. They used thermal-induced shattering, in which miners would light a fire beside the desired vein of ore, heating the rock surface, and then they would apply water to the hot surface, which would cause the rock to shatter, allowing for easier removal of the copper ore. They have figured a lot of things out, you know? They knew how to fold the copper and hammer it and produce the finished product that they were looking for. Many of the artifacts show extreme uniformity and quality, indicating a high degree of technological specialization. You know, they were very accomplished in the arts that they were doing. But again, the flood came and swept them away. That's our hypothesis that we feel is strongly supported. And following that, new civilizations had to rise up in the centuries following. One last note before we travel to our last stop for today, but on the old copper culture. So after it sharply declined in the use of copper tools and that culture was terminated there right near the date of Noah's flood, then in the cultures to come, you find them going back to stone and bone tools. And that's definitely a question that you would ask as a secular archaeologist. Why would you abandon your advanced technology and all that you had invested in being able to work this copper and go back to making tools out of stones and bones? Like, that definitely seems more primitive. But once again, if you look at it in the light of a flood sweeping everybody away and then new people having to start over, they're not going to have the numbers of people required to do copper metallurgy, and they may just not have had the technology, or you can just imagine that they would have had to go back to more primitive types of tools, as we also see like in the archaeology at Palestine, for example.
All right, well, we're going to travel now to our final destination, as we've been traveling around the world on this episode, and see if we see another cultural break around the same time. We're staying in North America. We're going to go 532 miles now down from the Great Lakes into Cedar County, Missouri. Cedar County, Missouri has a very famous archaeological site called the Big Eddy. The Big Eddy site, first excavated in 1997, so not that long ago, really.
We were in college.
Yes,
we were. Can you believe that?
We're getting older.
we were in college when this was first being excavated.
Yes.
But, I mean, that does show us that science is constantly building and there's new areas, new territory to be explored in every branch of science,
right.
And archaeology is no different.
So we're dealing with the American Indians and still dealing with these ancient peoples here in North America. We're looking for a termination of occupation, a depopulation, just like we have in these other five sites.
At the very least, we have to see a break in culture,
right.
Near that date of Noah's flood. We right. cannot see a continuity of culture.
In this particular site, we have, even though it's only been excavated since 1997, it goes way back. It is showing culture 12, 13, even more thousand years ago. And that's what makes this site such an important place, is that I think there's a river there that has covered over and preserved so much of what they are finding at the Big Eddy site. But when we get to, I looked this up and did a little research online. We looked up Wikipedia. We looked up Missouri State University, missouristate.edu. And there's a nice little chart we have here, cultural layers at the Big Eddy site. And you can see way back, 13,000, 12,500 different, and they're different names, of course, pre-Clovis culture, Clovis culture. But then you get on up the time frame, the time scale on the chart, you get to what's called the Middle Archaic Period. And that is 5,500 to 8,000 years old. And then the Late Archaic Period, 2,500 to 5,500 years old. So what are we seeing here? We are seeing a break in culture 5,500 years ago.
Yes, and that's exactly the time from the present back is 5,500
right.
years to take us back to the time, the biblical chronology date for Noah's flood of 3520 BC.
Right in the middle of the fourth millennium BC, an evident and massive break in culture. Of course, now we have, this is our sixth site that we have shown breaks in established cultures at the same time.
It's fascinating looking at this chart on missouristate.edu. The Middle Archaic Period is what ends right there at our date for Noah's flood. But that period lasted 2,500 years.
Yeah.
So 2,500 years of the Middle Archaic Period, and then there's a break followed by the Late Archaic Period, which lasts 3,000 years.
Right.
So you got 2,500 years on one side, 3,000 on the other side, and a break right there at the time that we expect for the date of Noah's flood.
And again, to find a break in a culture in one culture is extremely rare. But to find this now in multiple cultures worldwide at the same time.
Right, separated by thousands of miles.
And we have this ancient account that talks about a worldwide flood that happened at this very time when the chronology is corrected. I think it's pretty clear. These requirements are all being met in too many locations and it's all just adding up. The puzzle pieces are falling into place.
And you know, what happened? Well, I have a little challenge for our listeners, but let me just give a couple of points of interest about the Big Eddy site. Apparently, many groups of prehistoric Indians, as they call it on missouristate.edu, prehistoric, chose the Big Eddy site as a place to camp over thousands of years. It was right beside a river, provided lots of natural resources and fish, waterfowl, aquatic plants they could eat, surrounding forest and prairie. So it was a really great place for Indians to inhabit, right. Either temporarily or it says camp there. So that's what those people groups were doing before the flood came and
yeah.
took them all away.
So let's wrap this up today. We have mentioned six sites where a major cultural change, depopulation event took place at the same time, middle of the fourth millennium BC, around the date of 3500 BC. South Mesopotamia with the late Uruk collapse. Palestine with the terminating of the Chalcolithic period. Greece with the termination of the final Neolithic in the Aegean culture. Ireland, with the evidence there in the fields, in the Cajun fields, and these people who suddenly went missing. North America at the Great Lakes and the ending of the old copper culture. And then North America again, they're in Missouri at the Big Eddy and the break that happened 5,500 years ago. One right after another, showing us something took place in this world in the middle of the 4th millennium BC across what we've seen here, the Northern Hemisphere, that changed cultures worldwide. And we have an account in the Bible, when you get the date right, that tells us that God allowed a flood of water to cover this world, that people were swept away, cultures swept away by what we call Noah's flood. And this is just fascinating evidence.
Speaking of evidence, we should mention as we wrap up this main topic today, we've talked all about these cultural breaks that we see in archaeology spanning these wide distances across the globe. But there are other pieces of evidence that are not from archaeology that are also showing a major disruption, showing a big anomaly of some sort right at the same date or in the same range of dates.
Right. The cultural breaks are just part of the story.
Right. As far as the evidence goes, as we're looking in science at this date, couple places to mention would be Elk Lake in Minnesota and the sediments there. There is a lot of well-documented science been done there. It's a geophysical reservoir that tells a story as you go back down through those sediments and as they analyze and date things. And there's a big anomaly right in the middle of that fourth millennium. That's not a break in culture. That's not archaeology. That's a totally different method of investigation. And then another one is the ice cores that have been done up in Greenland. And same kind of thing. They can drill way down into the ice. They can learn so much about history. And once again, there is something very unusual back in the middle of the fourth millennium BC. So you again, get the flood book. You can get a free download. You can purchase a hard copy of the book. It will explain a lot more about this. But I just thought it would be good to mention that these cultural breaks are not the only place we can go to learn more and get confirmation of this flood event. But back to the archaeology, what we've given here is by no means an exhaustive list. And that's where my little challenge comes in for our listeners. Maybe you have time or have an interest in a certain area in the world that's done archaeology going back this far. And maybe you would like to study up on a certain ancient culture and send it in to us, what you find armed with the knowledge, you know, that we have up to this point going forward. What more can we discover and add to the list? Or if you find something that you think is against what we've presented today, hey, send that in to us and we'll let Dr. Ardsman take a look at it and we'll give you an honest and thoughtful response.
Well, God's judgment is something to behold. It's a terrible, terrible thing. We have seen God's judgment in the flood where many, many people perished. But the Bible very clearly says that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And of course, the Christmas season is when God sent his mercy and God sent his grace. And as horrible and terrible and awful as God's judgment is, the other side of that coin is that God's mercy is unfathomable and his grace. That's what Christmas is all about. The coming of, not judgment, the coming of a redeemer into this world so that many will not perish.
Long lay the world in sin and error pining till he appeared. And as we go into Helen's view, we're going to meditate and think upon this precious biblical account of the appearing of the Son of God into the world through the eyes of Mary.
One little person in the world who was obedient, who wanted to follow the Lord, who had a heart that wanted to be right with God, like Noah did, apparently, in the Old Testament, God brings through her this wonderful redemption. And yes, Helen and Gerald have put together a very neat, touching little account to get into the story, into their minds, in the life of Mary and Elizabeth as this baby is coming into the world.
Something a little different for the Real Bible section of our podcast today, Helen's View.
In 1995, I began a publication called The Mother's Companion to encourage Christian women in the art of mothering. For the 1996 Christmas edition, Gerald and I wrote a fiction piece about Mary and Elizabeth called Be It Unto Me. I have chosen to share this piece with you this month. Maybe your children and or grandchildren could sit down with you over a cup of hot cider and a Christmas cookie and listen to it together. Be it unto me. I lay down, but I knew sleep would be impossible. My mind was whirling with so many thoughts and questions, and my eyes were still burning from the angelic light. Me bearing a child, the child, the long-awaited Messiah? Nothing shall be impossible, the angel had said, but why this dull ache in my heart? I tossed and turned for hours as my jumbled thoughts slowly untangled themselves. Eventually the problem came into focus. No, it was not unbelief, nor was it any unwillingness to serve the Lord in this way. Indeed, my heart glowed even now with the same burning joy with which it had responded to the angel's message just hours previously. Nor was I concerned for my personal safety or reputation. Many, I knew, would not understand my prenuptial pregnancy. Ordinarily, the law commanded stoning in such cases, and slander and gossip were inevitable in any event. I had understood the risks and consequences right from the start. I had surrendered myself and my reputation to God, believing he could look after the consequences. When I said to the angel, Behold, the handmaid of the Lord, be it unto me according to your word. I had no desire or any intention of violating these sincere words of personal consecration. No, it was none of these things. It was Joseph. The problem finally having come clear, I turned to God in prayer. Oh, Jehovah, what about Joseph? He is so kind and so sensitive, and I love him so much. How will he feel? How can I bear to wound him with this news? Will he not naturally conclude that I have been unfaithful to our pledge of love? And will this not crush him bitterly? Oh, God, how can I let this happen to Joseph? Must my obedience to you cost Joseph so high a price? But there was no answer in the darkness. No angelic presence lit the room. I thought daylight would never come as the night dragged on and on. I drifted into an exhausted sleep as the final hour of the night ebbed away, only to be startled awake by a sudden thought. Elizabeth! The angel had said that she also had conceived a son. She who had been barren all her life and was now an old woman. Her pregnancy was an impossible one, too. I must go and talk with Elizabeth. As the dawn began to break, there came a peace and inner resolution. I would go see Elizabeth and stay with her. I knew that this urging was from the Lord in answer to my prayer. No doubt she would welcome some help around the house in her pregnant condition. It would give me a chance to sort out my own emotions. And there were so many things I now needed to learn about, pregnancy and birthing and caring for an infant. Who better to learn from than wise, humble, sweet Elizabeth? It would put off my having to break the news to Joseph and leave his heart undisturbed a little longer. Yes, I would travel with the next caravan to Jerusalem. Joseph came to the house to see me off. I felt so embarrassed around him. I didn't really know what to say. We had always been so open with each other before, and I didn't like keeping this secret from him now. It broke my heart to see his questioning look. I tried to reassure him that everything was fine, that I was just going to help Elizabeth for a few months. I could tell he wasn't convinced, that he sensed something was amiss, but in his characteristic gentle strength, he didn't press me. He just softly spoke his love and told me to enjoy this rare vacation. I wanted so much to confide in him, but it seemed impossible to do so. I was both relieved and regretful as the caravan finally started out. The sky was bright and the early morning sun was warm. It was a beautiful morning, but I hardly noticed. I was lost in thought as we traveled along. As Nazareth slowly faded from view behind us, I determined to think only about what lay ahead. The second day's travel was much the same as the first, beautiful in the morning, but slow, hot, and wearisome by midday. But at last I could see the hill country where Elizabeth lived. I couldn't wait to see her and hear all about her pregnancy. I had so many questions for her. I hope she will be there and not away visiting relatives, I thought. Finally, we began the ascent up the hill to Elizabeth's hometown. Evening was fast approaching, and I was hungry and tired as we passed the town gates. Dear God, please have Elizabeth be home, I prayed. Our caravan was welcomed by many friendly greetings from people of the town. Though it had been quite some time since I had last been here, nothing much had changed. When I arrived at Elizabeth's front door, all was quiet. The bell clanged loudly as I rang it. I was relieved when a voice requested that I enter. My first sight of Elizabeth was rather shocking. At first her back was turned to me, but as I entered the eating area, she stood and turned to greet me with an exclamation of joyous surprise. Her hair was now completely white, and her complexion was wrinkled, and these familiar characteristics of old age contrasted curiously with her rounded tummy. How strange the ways of God, I thought. He has chosen this old barren woman to have a special baby for him, and me, an unknown girl from a poor family in Nazareth, to carry and birth the Messiah. I greeted Elizabeth by her old family name, Elisheba. At this greeting, she clutched her stomach and cried, "Oh, the baby just jumped!" Then she fixed her eyes on me and said, "God has blessed you more than any other woman, and God has blessed the baby which you will give birth to. You are the mother of my Lord, and you have come to me. Why has something so good happened to me?" Tears began to flow down both our faces as she continued, "When I heard your voice, the baby inside me jumped with joy. You are blessed because you believed that what the Lord said to you would really happen." How she encouraged my heart as she spoke those words. She at least understood and approved of my pregnancy, and before I had even said a word about it to anyone. Such affirmation from this godly older woman meant more to me in that moment than I can ever say. Through tears of joy, I replied, "My soul praises the Lord. My heart is happy because God is my Savior. I am not important, but God has shown his care for me, his servant girl. From now on, all people will say that I am blessed, because the powerful one has done great things for me. His name is holy. God will always give mercy to those who worship him. God's arm is strong. He scatters the people who are proud and think great things about themselves. God brings down rulers from their thrones, and he raises up the humble. God fills the hungry with good things, but he sends the rich away with nothing. God has helped his people Israel who serve him. He gave them his mercy. God has done what he promised to our ancestors, to Abraham and to his children forever." We cried and embraced for several minutes. Then we both began to speak at once. But Elizabeth soon insisted I sit down and rest and have some supper. "We can talk later," she said. Zacharias began to motion to Elizabeth. I had been so absorbed in Elizabeth's greeting, I hadn't noticed until now how unusually quiet Zacharias had been since I had come in. Elizabeth quickly explained the circumstances surrounding Zacharias' silence, his encounter with the angel while serving in the temple, in which he had been struck dumb. What a contrast, I thought, between the outpouring of God's supernatural presence at this time and the centuries of silence which have preceded it. After a refreshing meal together, Elizabeth and I sat and talked long into the night. First, Elizabeth told her story. She told of how the angel had come to her husband with the astounding news that he would have a son. The angel had said that he was to be called John, and that he would play a very special part in the preparation for the Messiah's appearance. Unfortunately, he wasn't as quick to believe God as you were, Mary, she chuckled, taking Zacharias's bony hand in hers and giving it a loving pat. And now he has to listen to me do all the talking. Zacharias merely responded with a happy grin. Mary, the angel said that my baby will be great in the sight of the Lord and be filled with the Holy Spirit even from my womb. Why should God bestow upon me this wonderful privilege? And now to be given the joy of being in the presence of my Savior even before he has been born. And then it was my turn to tell my miraculous story. Zacharias and Elizabeth both wept silently as I shared about the angel's visit and his great pronouncement to me. Elizabeth, I am going to have a baby too, the Messiah. I feel so completely fulfilled to serve God in this way, and I am so happy to do so. But I don't really know anything about pregnancy or childbirth or caring for a baby. Could I possibly stay with you a while? I could help around the house and help you as you prepare for the birth of your baby. I have so much to learn, and you could teach me so many things. I would love to attend your baby's birth and help you afterwards. I feel it could help us both. Elizabeth and Zacharias looked at one another, their eyes twinkling. Elizabeth said, Mary, you are an answer to our prayers. It's not easy for this old lady to keep up with the housework and carry a baby, too. Zacharias and I have been praying about what to do about it. You have been sent by the Lord. The days that followed seemed to fly by. We would do all the housework in preparation for meals in the cool of the mornings and evenings. I did all the shopping for Elizabeth while she stayed inside the house. Though this pregnancy in her old age was a special sign from God, few of her neighbors thought so. They said her aged pregnancy was unnatural, by which, unfortunately, they did not mean miraculous, but rather indiscreet and indecent. Her neighbors were good, God-fearing folk, but as is often the case, they were having trouble grasping what God was doing in Elizabeth's life. I guess they somehow assumed that God's miracles would always be comfortable things, culturally acceptable and dignified. Each day brought with it the usual activities. We worked together grinding wheat for cakes, preparing the fire to cook them, and cleaning up the dishes. We swept and tidied and scrubbed and hung out the laundry together. There were figs and grapes to dry for the cold months ahead, olive oil lamps to be cleaned and filled, and fresh produce from the garden to be picked and prepared for meals each day. And all the while we talked about babies, babies, and babies. Poor Zacharias, he spent a lot of time in his garden. After lunch, we would each retire to our rooms for a nap. Then we would meet in the late afternoon during the hottest part of the day to sew. As Elizabeth worked on her baby clothes, I worked on mine. I made my first shawls and linen coverings for my baby. Elizabeth taught me fine embroidery, which we put on the hems of all the garments. As we sewed, we talked more about babies. Elizabeth passed along so many helpful ideas. Though this would be her first child, she had cared for nieces and nephews of all ages for years and had a wealth of experience to share. Growing up, I had just assumed that mothering skills came as part of the package with the arrival of the first baby. I now saw how wrong I had been and how much I had to learn, and I was deeply thankful for this time with Elizabeth. We often shared verses from the law and the prophets. They came up naturally as we talked about raising godly children for Jehovah. And occasionally we would sing praises to God together as we worked. Elizabeth was a continuous fountain of joy. Her thankful spirit was contagious. It was a blessed time. As the time for Elizabeth's birth drew near, she began an incredible house cleaning. Her energy amazed me as I worked beside her, and then she retired to her room. I could tell the time was close and that she wanted to be alone. I knew she would be spending it in prayer and the recitation of the Psalms as she gathered her physical and spiritual strength for the impending birth. Several days later, Elizabeth complained of feeling very uncomfortable. She rested most of the day and ate and spoke little. I reassured her that I would get the midwife when she felt like calling for her. I sat with her and tried to encourage her that the long-awaited birth was imminent and that soon she would have a very special baby to love and nurse. Zachariah took my place when he got home that evening. I made supper, then cleaned up and retired to my room. I had just fallen asleep for the night when Zacharias woke me and told me to get the midwife. She was only several houses down, and we quickly returned to the house together. Zacharias went into the garden to pray, and I did whatever the midwife requested of me. I watched with some anxiety as Elizabeth groaned on her bed with pain. I clutched my stomach and wondered how I would ever be able to do what she was doing. I tried to be brave for Elizabeth's sake, but I made sure she couldn't see my face, which I was sure was betraying me. The labor was long, a slowly accelerating cycle of contractions and rest. After many hours, Elizabeth's groaning changed somewhat, and the midwife began telling her to push down hard, that she would soon see her baby. As best I could judge, Elizabeth wasn't thinking much about babies at this point, but only how to get rid of the pain. Still, she was amazing to watch as she gathered up her strength and pushed. What she lacked in youthful muscle, she certainly made up for in seasoned sinew. The final stage of labor, with its grueling pushing, seemed like hours, though in fact it didn't last all that long. Eventually the head emerged, topped with masses of beautiful dark curly hair. The midwife was talking very gently to Elizabeth now, urging her to give one more small push. Though visibly exhausted, she gathered her strength again and pushed one last time. Yes, a baby boy, just as the angel had foretold. He cried lustily as the midwife tenderly put him in Elizabeth's arms. The smile, which Elizabeth now radiated, was truly wonderful to see. Tears were coming down both our faces as she cooed to her baby and touched his tiny hands. All the pain and discomfort of the last hours were clearly worth it to Elizabeth for even just this one moment. Elizabeth said, "Do you know how many years I have longed to have a child of my own to love? The Lord has taken away my shame. He has granted my desire and longing for a child. Oh, praise the Lord, the God of Israel." She held the baby to her breast, and he began sucking vigorously. "Mary, summon Zacharias," she said. The room became silent as Zacharias knelt by Elizabeth's bed and watched his son contentedly sucking at his wife's breast. Tears of joy streamed down his old face as he tenderly stroked Elizabeth's arm. "God has been so good. The midwife and I left them alone to share the joy of this long-awaited moment in private." While the midwife retired to the kitchen for a hot drink, I went out to the garden and took in the ever-exhilarating panorama of moon and stars. It was a beautiful, clear night. I thought of Joseph back home and longed to be with him. I would need to head for home in just a few days now. My apprenticeship under Elizabeth was obviously nearly complete. But still, I quailed at the thought of telling Joseph of my pregnancy. I finally confided my fears to Elizabeth the evening before I was to leave for home. She was rocking John as she nursed him. He was dressed in one of the beautiful embroidered gowns she had so lovingly prepared for him. His dark hair contrasted beautifully with his white linen gown. Though a week had passed, Elizabeth's delight in John had not dimmed. In fact, her mother love had only grown. She seldom took her eyes off his tiny form. "Elizabeth," I said, "I need to talk to you about something important before I go. You know how happy I am to serve God in bearing this child. I really don't care what others might think or say. I know I have been obedient to the Lord, and my relationship to him is more important than anything else. But I'm confused and troubled about Joseph. Elizabeth, I love him so much. I just don't know how I can face him with this news. He'll be so hurt. He'll surely think I have been unfaithful. I spoke with the angel. I saw his shining radiance and heard his heaven-sent message. And I've seen and heard what God has done in your lives. But Joseph has been a part of none of this. I fear the truth will seem terribly far-fetched to him. Elizabeth, he is strong in mind and body, but his heart is sensitive and tender. I know this news will crush him. I don't want that to happen. Oh, Elizabeth, do you understand? What should I do?" "Oh, Mary," she said, "have you been harboring this burden all these months? You should have talked with me about it sooner." She continued to rock silently for a few minutes. I waited, knowing she was collecting her thoughts and seeking wisdom from God. As she looked up at me, there was a softness in her eyes and a tenderness in her voice as she spoke. "There is nothing unusual or unnatural about the way you feel, Mary. We all want to protect those we love from hurt and pain. It is a curious fact that it is often easier to suffer pain ourselves than to watch those we love do so. And it is often easier to surrender our own way unto the Lord than it is to let God have his way with our loved ones. Mary, do you know that as a young woman I was proud, self-assured, and insensitive? I see you find this hard to believe, but it is sadly true. I was very resourceful, and I thought I could handle any situation and accomplish whatever I pleased. But after Zacharias and I had been married several years, I realized that I could not conceive, and no amount of resourcefulness on my part could change that fact. I have lived with the pain and reproach of barrenness for many decades, Mary, and there is no denying it has changed me. But I, more than anybody else, know the change has only been for the better, even though the experience has not been pleasant. Mary, God does not send us pain because he hates us, but only because he loves us. It is his tool to chip away all that is ugly about us. Would I be better off a haughty, self-centered grandmother than I am this day? Would you have done me a favor if you had been somehow able to shelter me from the pain of barrenness those many decades? Mary, we must let the pain God sends into the lives of those we love have its perfect work. If we try to shelter them from it, we only deny them God's instrument of love, and we ultimately do them great harm. Sleep came easily that night. God had challenged me, I knew, through the words of Elizabeth, to yet a higher plane of surrender and consecration. As I drifted off to sleep, I prayed, "Behold, the handmaid of the Lord, be it unto me, and all I hold dear, according to your good pleasure." The End. Written by Helen and Gerald Ardsma, Christmas 1996.
Well, amen. We appreciate that. And a beautiful account there of the Christmas story, part of the Christmas story. And we hope you enjoyed that. Maybe read that together with some family and friends this Christmas season. We always appreciate you joining us on the podcast. It's almost the end of 2025.
Thank you for listening all the way to the end here. And don't go away yet, because we want to give you just a little glimpse of what we have planned for January, which will be our next episode, January of 2026. Starting out the new year, we've decided to go ahead and maybe stir the pot just a little bit.
Stir the pot a little bit.
We're usually so kind. We try not to single anybody out or name any names for groups that maybe are putting out content that we do not feel holds up to a high standard, of a high view of both Bible and science, and being honest with both. There is a new book just come out recently about Noah's flood.
The topic is Noah's flood again.
Yes. Which we spent quite a while discussing on this episode. We are going to delve into this book next month.
It presents new depths of insight from science and scripture. That's what it says right there on the book. We got the book.
Right.
New depths of insight from science and scripture. Well, does this book offer data showing the reality of the biblical flood account? This is a fellow who's widely listened to on these topics. His name's Hugh Ross. I'm sure you've probably heard of Hugh Ross and Reasons to Believe, and we appreciate what these groups are trying to do for Christianity.
But next month, we're going to open up the pages of this new book on the flood, and we are going to investigate where this book takes us, what kind of real answers it gives us in the pursuit of truth and the pursuit of giving a data-rich apologetic for the Christian faith. We're going to give you our take on this new book next month in our January episode, so stay tuned.
Hugh Ross brings up Dr. Ardsma in the book, by the way. This is kind of what got us into this.
We'll explain more next month, but he promised he was going to address some of Ardsma's claims in this book. And so that was one reason we were excited to get it and to check into it. And so we'll let you know what we found next month.
So tune in next month. Thank you for joining us today on this podcast. We hope that you have a wonderful Christmas season with your family and friends, and are comforted and blessed by the reality of God sending his mercy and redemption into the world through his Son, Jesus Christ, celebrated at Christmas.
Blessings to you as you close out the year, and we will see you in January.